fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side.
Well, welcome to The Other Side today, and I think we're going to have a very interesting and very different conversation. From time to time on this program, we will talk about the topic of self-help. And much of the self-help material out there is, you know, how can I be richer? How can I be fitter? How can I be the best? And almost like you think of it like somebody with out of a toothpaste ad, you know, they've got the bright smile and everything's always great. Well, the book we're going to talk about today is decidedly different. We're going to talk about the book, How to Suffer in 10 Easy Steps, Discover, Embrace, and Own the Mechanics of Misery. Our guest is William Arntz, and he has a very interesting background. He is the author of the book, and he began his professional career, though, as a research laser physicist developing wave optic simulators for the high-energy laser systems that became the Star Wars SDI system. Then he took an interesting left turn. He left the scientific world and spent 20 years studying with two spiritual teachers. Now, during that time, he wrote a software product, AutoSys, that he was able to sell for millions. And following that, he followed his lifelong passion for filmmaking. He used the proceeds to produce, direct, and write the film, What the Bleep Do We Know?, incorporating his scientific background, spiritual training, and desire to make people laugh and think. And we're so glad to have him with us, William Arntz. Thank you, sir, for joining us. And I know we had some tech issues on my side, some power outages and so forth. So we appreciate your forbearance and patience.
Well, I'm happy we made it. I'm here in Southern California now where they have the rounding blackout, so it's good to hear that someone else is having it too.
Well, I think that it's we're talking about suffering, and we joked off air that you have some material in this book about techno suffering, and it just seemed very synchronistic that all this happened today. But so be it, because part of life is definitely suffering. So when we were talking earlier today, you said something to the effect that this is almost the exact opposite of a lot of the self-help material that's out there. How so? How is it that way?
Well, it's the opposite in a couple ways. One of the ways is, like you said, so much of the self-help stuff is like how to be very wealthy in 5 easy steps, how to find your true love in 7 easy steps, and how to do, you know, effortless success. And, you know, that's kind of the promise. And anyone you talk to who's been, for instance, successful, you say, hey, was it easy? They all, just myself included, you just shake your head and say, oh, my God, it was hard, hard work. So I sort of kind of roll my eye. I mean, these self-help books do help people, actually, but also I think there's a bit of the promise that often isn't met, that it's, you know, easy steps will get you there. So in my book, How to Suffer in 10 Easy Steps, I figure it's the only self-help book that really delivers on the promise. Because we know suffering is easy because no one wants to suffer, and yet everyone does it. So therefore, it must be easy. So, you know, that's kind of the take, that this is the one self-help book that really, you know, delivers, and there are easy steps. Now, the thing about it being an inverse, as I call it, is that, you know, the idea is, aside from sort of having a laugh at the whole thing, a bit of satire involved, you know, the other thing is like, well, if you see these are the easy steps to suffering, if you don't do it, then you won't suffer as much. It's kind of like that. So instead of hitting the nail on the head, we do the inverse and say, well, like one of the easy steps is do nothing. So if you're suffering and you do nothing about it, you'll just keep suffering. That's an easy step to keep suffering. So therefore, if you do the inverse, you know, do something, you have a chance of moving out of your suffering state. So that's the take on the self-help.
I have a couple of observations. I want to get your take on these observations. One of them, and I've said this many times on the program, is that take something like The Secret, the idea, and I'm probably oversimplifying it and so forth, that you can think positive thoughts and have an intention on something, and it will essentially materialize through a series of events put in forced by the universe. Now, I have always felt that there is legitimacy to the idea of positive thinking. I seem to feel like when I do something and I have a positive attitude towards it, and I work really hard, it tends to come out better than if I work really hard on something and I have a negative attitude. But for it to be successful, you have to have that component of hard work. I think you have to have both. You can't just be positive. What are your thoughts on that and the idea that there is a law of attraction and a certain amount of positivity that can help you in your life, but it also takes hard work?
Well, we could go on for 45 minutes on this one. Like you said, I made the film What the Bleep Do We Know, and there was a whole bit in there about creating reality. And after that film, The Secret came out, and so I'm very familiar with all that. And I agree with you. Having the positive attitude and having the thoughts and doing your vision board and doing all that stuff really helps. But there's the component of hard work. And the hard work component that I think most people miss is the deep self-reflection, psychological, spiritual work you have to do. Because you may have something, you may want to be successful. You may want that consciously more than anything, but there's subconscious things that are happening that are going to derail you from that. And so just thinking positive isn't enough. You also have to do the work to clear out the cellar, not cellar, S-E-L-L-E-R, but cellar like the ground, underneath the ground floor in the unconscious where things are lurking. And so you have to get down there too and do the work there so that the positive, because otherwise your subconscious will just derail everything you do. So, when The Secret came out, I had a little bit of my eye rolling thing because, you have these guys up there talking about, oh, I did this and, it worked well. And that's true, that happens, but you're looking at 0.1% if you look at all the people who do it and it doesn't work. And the trouble with having it put out like all you have to do is think positive and it works is then people get disillusioned. People say, I've been doing the practice, I've been saying my 53 mantras every morning about getting a new Mercedes and it hasn't shown up, so I'm just going to throw up my hands, this stuff doesn't work. And I think there is a chance of people getting disillusioned and really giving up because they said, well, I did this, I did my affirmation every morning and it didn't happen. Well, it's more than just an affirmation, folks.
I want to get to the book, but I want to get your take on one other observation or thought that I've had over the years. My wife and I discussed that. We're middle-aged. We have teenage kids. And, we're around a lot of teenage kids. And most of the kids are, relatively well off. That you would think from the outside that they have every reason to be happy. And so many of them seem upset or full of angst. I think part of that's just being a teenager, right? But I also think, I have a feeling, and maybe I'm wrong, but that our society has painted a picture that life is supposed to be perfect and free of suffering. We're all supposed to look like, the person that spends 6 days a week in the gym, and we're all supposed to drive a Mercedes, and we're all supposed to have the latest iPhone, and all of these things. And then if your life falls short in any one of those ways, or you don't quite meet that expectation, then it plunges people I don't really want to get into mental health aspects, but it does kind of plunge them into anxiety. And do you think there's something to that, that we've been so fed that we can be perfect, we should be perfect, and there are a lot of people out there who are perfect, that if we in any way fall short, that it really hits us where we live?
Well, you are absolutely 100% right. You're absolutely right. I mean, you look at, for instance, the amount of teenage suicide going on. It's off the charts. It's just, like we've never seen before, at least, in America. Whereas the teenagers, like you said, are suffering on the material level, are just doing better than generations have ever done. And yet we see this rise in teenage suicide. And I talk about that in the book because exactly what you're saying is right. Just because you have all that stuff, it doesn't make suffering go away. In fact, you read people like Robin Williams, for instance. I mean, here was someone immensely successful, loved by millions and millions of people, and he committed suicide. So the notion that by getting something out there, and for myself included, I mean, I've been very successful. I had two software companies. I made the movie that was seen around the world, fulfilling a lifelong dream, blah, blah, blah. And still, stuff happens, and I suffer. I mean, I just, you know, there's times that things happen that I'm miserable. So that notion that by having the right thing out there is going to make your life wonderful is just not right. It's just not true. And I think it's something that, you know, really needs to be addressed, which is part of why I wrote the book.
Well, one thing that I deal with on the other end of the age spectrum is my elderly father, who, you know, I love dearly, and he's 84 years old, and God bless him, he's doing well physically and everything, but he tends to be on the other side of the fence. Everything's horrible all the time. And what I try to say to him and what I try to say to my kids is that good things are a part of life, and there are definitely some really great things to celebrate. We've got enough to eat. We've got a roof over our heads. That's something to celebrate. Our relatively good health is something to celebrate. Having each other, that's something to celebrate. But there's also, pardon the expression, a lot of crap comes with life. And things don't always go right. And maybe I'm ready to do an interview and the power goes out, like happened earlier today. And I think we just have to accept that. You know what Forrest Gump said, life is a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And oh, guess what? Some of those chocolates are going to be rotten.
That is true. I have this thing in the book. I create this thing called a sufferometer. and the sufferometer, yeah, I have a chapter on, I call it the pseudoscience of suffering. You know, I'm scientific, so I come up with equations and whatnot, talk about suffering and draw charts. At the end, I say any science, even pseudoscience, needs a metric. So I have this sufferometer. And it's this gauge where you can say what your suffering is on. It's actually very useful. I won't get into that now, but it actually is really good to externalize your internal state. But at bottom, I have these things that I call sliders. You know, they're like sliders. And there's the one slider I have is called the creation slider. And on the one end is I create my reality. And that's what some folks say, that they create their reality on 100%. No matter what happens, they somehow created it. So that's the one end of the slider. And the other slider is shit happens. And that is just when shit happens. And sometimes it does. And you don't create it. You know, just the forest fire comes or whatever it is. Your car engine blows up. I mean, whatever it is, sometimes it's not something you did. It just happens. And that is part of life. In this physical world, things break. That's just, you know, I didn't set it up this way, but that's what happens. So I, you know, what you're saying is, yeah, that part of it is acceptance. When something is on that end of the spectrum, you didn't create it, but it just, you know, what can you do? I mean, and sometimes, I mean, we're out here in California where a year and a half ago, our house was surrounded on three sides by wildfire, and the fire came down to our property edge and burned all our hedges, and we thought the house was gone because we saw it on TV with the fire all around it. You know, and so that's at that end of the spectrum. Shit happens. And so you just, you know, things like that in your life happens. And it turns out that when you accept it, when you accept that reality, that that's just what sometimes happens no matter what, then, you know, you can move on as opposed to dwelling on it.
From Buddha came the saying, life is suffering. You have a chapter here that says Buddha kicks the habit. That sounds interesting. What's that all about?
Well, yeah, I was going to write the chapter, and I don't know why, I just thought about that. And what I've realized is there's a certain amount of suffering, certainly not all of it, but there's a certain amount of suffering that's just habitual. You know, we have these neural nets, the habits that are in the brain, emotional pathways, that once something happens over and over, it becomes easier and easier to go there. And so with suffering, things happen and you suffer, and it becomes a habit in the brain. Literally, in the brain, there are neural pathways that just will go to that place. And so when you start looking at it as a habit, that it's just a habit that humanity at large has fallen into, and a way to respond to the things in life, you say, oh, well, maybe this is a habit that I can kick, like, you know, having too many drinks at night. Or maybe it's a habit that I can kick of being nasty to people around me when I'm in a bad mood or whatever. But when you look at it as a habit, that kind of takes it from this dark, ominous thing, monster that's always out to get you, say, oh, in part, it's a habit. I can do something about that. And of course, once you feel that you can do something about it, that's very empowering.
One thing that's always fascinated me is the idea of self-sabotage. Now, I'll use myself as an example. I'm a social drinker. I can have a drink and leave it alone, where some people have one drink and they have to, you know, get uproaringly drunk. You know, I don't cheat on my wife. I don't cheat on my taxes. I'm an honest guy, but I am not physically in as good a shape as I should be. And there, you know, I'm 50 years old, prime heart attack time, folks. And I look at it and I still don't do as much as I should. I am trying, but I'm not doing, you know, as much as I should. And I know that, but I don't do it. And I think that many of us have like these blind spots in our life where we know we should be doing something better and we don't. Why is that? Do we sabotage ourselves?
Boy, that's a meaty question. Do we sabotage ourselves? Well, sometimes there is self-sabotage when there's something, you know, like some people want to be, they really want to be successful. They want to write a book. And every time they sit down to write the book, they always think about something else they have to do. So again, in that case, there's something deeper going on where they consciously think they want to write the book. Unconsciously, they don't want to write the book. And so there's a battle going on. But on the other hand, I mean, you know, it's the nature of the physical world that we're in when you're in a body is limitations. You can't do everything. So, yeah, you have so much energy, you have so much time to do things. And so, you know, you can say, well, I should be exercising more, but, you know, you look at what you're doing instead, and obviously that's more important to you. And I think pretty much everyone has stuff on the list they want to do that they just don't get to for one reason or another. Some of that, I'd say, is sabotage, and some of it is just like I said, there's only, as they say, so many hours in the day, and you choose where you're going to put your attention.
That's true. Something here looks humorous. You talk about the Suffering Hall of Fame. What in the world is the Suffering Hall of Fame?
Well, the way this book came about was I was walking through the living room one day, and my wife, Deirdre, was laying on the couch. Her back was out. I said, honey, how are you doing? And she didn't say anything. I said, what are you doing? She groans. I said, what? Well, do you want to go in the kitchen, maybe, you know, have a little Chardonnay or something, cheer you up? And she said, very small voice, I just want to lay here and suffer. And I stopped.
I don't mean to laugh
at
you.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's funny.
And I said, what? She goes, I'm perfecting my suffering. And I just started to laugh, just like you did. I said, someone needs to write a book, How to Suffer. It's a new self-help book, How to Suffer in 10 Easy Steps. And because both of us know a lot of self-help authors, we just started riffing on this, coming up with this, oh, it's got to do that. Da, da, da. And I said, yeah, there should be a Suffering Hall of Fame. And so we had a laugh about this whole idea of the self-help. I said, instead of calling it self-help, we'll call it self-hurt book, How to Suffer. So we just started joking about that, and part of it was the Suffering Hall of Fame. And so we had a good laugh over that, and 10 minutes later, she doesn't care that her back hurts anymore. She's up. We're in the kitchen. She had some Chardonnay, and, you know, life was good. And, you know, it's one of those things, you have these crazy ideas. You think you'll wake up the next morning and forget about it. And a month later, I'm still thinking about this crazy book. So I started writing it. But, you know, in reflecting, it was like, yeah, we had the good laugh. And then she wasn't suffering anymore. But part of it was because in that moment, she embraced it. You know, in the book, I say suffering is the gorilla in the room. It's the thing we never really talk about directly. We'll talk about our back is out. We'll talk about we have a lousy boss. We'll talk about we had a fight with our spouse. But you don't really say the bottom line is, and I am suffering. And because she was able to just admit it and go into it and experience it instead of denying it or, you know, trying to avoid it, pretty much 10 minutes later, she was done suffering, and we were having a laugh in the kitchen. So that was really part of what inspired me to continue with the book, realizing that there's something here that people aren't really talking about, but if they do, it would certainly help them.
Another thing is, I think that sometimes, and this is, you know, there's these trite sayings, but sometimes trite sayings, I think, have some truth to them. And this one is, you know, it's not what happens to you, it's how you react to it. And I've had times in my life where I've reacted to things poorly and I've been disappointed in myself. But actually, one of the times I was most proud of myself in retrospect was several years ago, my mother passed. And 2 weeks previously to that, an uncle of mine passed who was like a second dad to me. So we had a whole situation that many middle-aged people deal with. You had to, you know, kind of clear out and downsize property. I had to move my dad, you know, 300 miles and do all this pretty much on my own because my wife, dealing with her elderly father, who had health issues at the time, and my two young daughters who were in school. So I was kind of on an island here, and I felt that I dealt with it rather well. And in fact, I would point to that. I would have been like 43 years old at the time. That's when I became an adult, I feel, is that it took that long. I mean, not that I've been irresponsible. I'm a pretty responsible guy, but I really felt like I became an adult through that process. Now, if I could push a button and undo all that, and my mom would still be alive and my uncle would still be alive, and that wouldn't have happened, I'd love to have those people back. But the only thing that I can say, and it was not a positive experience, but the only positive that came out of it is I felt that in a difficult situation, I could deal with it in a good way and get things done and cope and get through it and move on to the next phase in life. And I think that's what taught me. So I guess even in the worst of circumstances, some kind of positive can come out of it.
Well, I have come to believe and accept that you know, you say, okay, why is there suffering? And I found, again, well, I'll be personal too in my life, nothing spurs me on to change more than suffering. In the end, that's what will spur someone to give up an old belief, to give up an old pattern, to change. And like you said, at the end of it, you came out, it wasn't fun, but in the end, you came out a different person. You had fundamentally changed. And really, that's what suffering is for. There's a point I make in the book. There's an old Vedanta thing. It's called the five kleshas, which are the reasons, the causes of suffering. And the first one is all suffering is caused by the misapprehension of the nature of reality. Now, that sounds a little abstract. They go on to four more, but all other four is like suffering is caused by the fear of death. But suffering is caused by clinging to the insubstantial. But if you say the nature of reality here is the physical world is transient. It all goes away. So if you cling to it, you will suffer. So the notion that basically suffering is caused by not perceiving reality as it is, well, then you can flip that and say, so therefore, the reason for suffering is to get you to perceive reality as it is, to get you in step with what is real. And if you're not in step with what is real, then you will suffer. So for you, I would say that, you know, going through that difficult situation, you know, you really had to go to a deeper part of yourself, which is your truer self, more of your true reality, and basically take that on and become that. So that's why I think, you know, the suffering is really there. And when you look at Buddha, you know, Buddha eventually said, I've realized the nature of physical life is suffering, and I suffer no longer, because he perceived the ultimate reality. So that's kind of a convoluted answer to what you said, but...
And let me make it very clear. I haven't suffered 0.01% as much as many people. I think of people who have terminal illnesses and they show such courage. And you wonder, how in the world could they do that? But somehow they have the strength. Not all of them, obviously. I mean, some people spiral, and it's totally understandable when you're met with that kind of news. But some people, I think of... the gentleman, Dr. Pausch, I think it was, who did the last lecture. People who use this to help others, and I'm sure they have their difficult times, but deal with something like a terminal illness. And it's amazing to me that those people are really something that I look to and admire what they make of a very, very difficult situation.
Well, that brings up an important point, and that is the choice that all of us have in how we react to the suffering. In my book, I have a younger sister, I had a younger sister, and she fought cancer for 8 years. And it's progressed, it just got worse and worse, and she was just wonderful about it. I mean, she'd still get depressed and cry and that, but most of the time, I mean, I would go into chemotherapy with her, she would go there, and all the nurses were, oh, Kate's here, oh, we're so happy to see her, oh, she always cheers us all up. And I would just watch all that, and it was like, you know, on the one hand, wow, that's really inspiring that she can do that. On the other hand, it told me, like, you know, in those situations, you have some control. You have quite a bit of control as to how much the situation is going to get to you. You know, when you feel powerless, that's when it's really bad. But when you realize that even having that cancer, you know, she didn't like it, but she was able to do something quite extraordinary. And even her doctors, I mean, I would go in, we would see the doctors, and the doctors were always saying, oh, Kate, you're so happy to see you. You're our favorite patient. And it's really amazing. But the thing to remember in all this is that everyone has a choice into how you're going to respond to what happens out there.
Now, to maybe close things out on a little lighter note, and then we'll let people know where they can pick up the book, techno suffering. And we suffered through some of that today. We had a power outage here, and our interview got interrupted, and we had to redo it a little bit later. Talk to us. It seems like with all the gadgets and gizmos, there's probably a whole lot of techno suffering out there.
There is a lot of techno suffering. And I see this all the time. I mean, you have something, you look it up on your phone, but oh my God, the phone updated last night automatically. They moved that around. I wonder where that is. This app doesn't work on the new OS. Let me go download the app. The download didn't work. Oh my God, my battery just ran out in the middle of the download. Now let me go plug it. You know, it just, that this technology, our lives have gotten so complicated and so interrelated that there is a lot of, you know, suffering going on because of all of these devices that are supposed to make our life better. And of course, that's the irony of it. All these computers, all this stuff that's supposed to help our life. And what has it done? It's made people who, instead of working 40 hours a week, now work 60 hours a week and never have a weekend off because their boss may text them at 5 o'clock Saturday night about closing some sales deal. I mean, I see this all the time. So it's all this suffering. And unfortunately, we've brought it on ourselves with all this technology and all these gizmos that are supposed to make our life better. I got to tell you, I don't really see people are happier now than they were back in 56 when I was a kid. So that's the techno suffering thing. It's, as they say, the guardian has become the guard.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting.
The thing that is supposed to help us is actually now enslaved us. And basically, you know, these devices run everyone's life. They're supposed to help our life. They're not supposed to run it.
It's true. It's like the electronic leash in terms of your work. And I have my own little media company here, and I find that I can never really truly be off. I've got to periodically check in and make sure the websites are still up and that there was no, you know, 3 a.m. email from from one of our customers having an issue or something like that. There's almost no downtime now.
Right. And unfortunately, that is driving everyone crazy. Everyone, this anxiety, and you can see in our society, I mean, this horrible thing about all the shootings that are going on, you know, it's because people are just too stressed out. I mean, it even says in the good book, God took the seventh day off. You know, it's like people, you need downtime. You need in the evening downtime. You need on the weekend downtime, because otherwise people just go wacky. So, even though he said we were going to end on a more positive note, here we are talking about people going wacky, but at least you laugh, so there you go. So.
Well, the thing is that there's always hope, but I think that there's I've been talking about a lot of sayings, but I think you've got to take the good with the bad and realize that it's just, you know, it's part of life and suffering. is part of life, or life is suffering. And that's why we talked today about how to suffer in 10 easy steps. Discover, embrace, and own the mechanics of misery. The author is William Arntz, and he's joined us today and been very generous with his time. William, where can people find the book?
Well, the URL is, believe it or not, howtosuffer.me. Believe it or not, you type in howtosuffer.me, M-E, and it'll go to our website. And then there's stuff about the book there. I filmed a bunch of videos talking about the book. And then, of course, from there, there's links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble where you can buy the book. And there's some articles on there, too. So howtosuffer.me. Easy to remember.
Easy to remember, indeed. William Arntz, it's been a lot of fun. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
I enjoyed speaking with William Arntz about the subject of suffering. And you would think that would be something you wouldn't enjoy, but I think it's good to be realistic and realize that sometimes life isn't a bowl of cherries, as they say, but sometimes it's pretty great. And you're one of the great things in my life, being a Plus Club member. And thank you for allowing me to do this and kind of have my dream job. So thank you so much for what you do. And certainly doing these shows is not suffering. I love doing it. And thank you for giving me that opportunity. We'll talk to you next time. And hopefully there won't be much suffering in your life between now and then. And I thank you for being a part of The Other Side. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.